3. He walked slowly over to a chair and sat down, now massaging both temples. The nukes. Of course it had been the nukes, what else? If it wasn't Chernobyl, it was Seabrook. And if it wasn't Seabrook, it was 3 Mile Island. And if it wasn't 3 Mile Island, it was Maine Yankee in Wiscasset. Or what could have happened at the Hanford plant in Washington State if someone hadn't happened to notice just in the nick of time that their used core rods, stored in an unlined ditch outside, were getting ready to blow sky high. How many nicks of time could there be? Spent fuel rods that were stacking up in big hot piles. They thought the curse of King Tut was bad? Brother. Wait until some 25th century archaeologist dug up a load of this shit. You tried to tell people the whole thing was a lie, nothing but a bald-faced, naked lie, that nuclear-generated power was eventually going to kill millions and render huge tracts of land sterile and unlivable. What you got back was a blank stare. You talked to people who had lived through one administration after another in which their elected officials told one lie after another, then lied about the lies, and when those lies were found out, the liars said, "Oh, geez, I forgot, sorry." And since they forgot, the people who elected them behaved like Christians and forgave. You couldn't believe there were so fucking many of them willing to do that until you remembered what P.T. Barnum said about the extraordinarily high birth rate of suckers. They looked you square in the face when you tried to tell them the truth and informed you that you were full of shit. The American government didn't tell lies. Not telling lies was what made America great. Oh, dear Father, here's the facts. I did it with my little axe. I can't keep silent, for it was I, and come what may, I cannot tell a lie. When you tried to talk to them, they looked at you as if you were babbling in a foreign language. It had been 8 years since he had almost killed his wife, and 3 since he and Bobby had been arrested at Seabrook. Bobby on the general charge of illegal demonstration, Guard on a much more specific one, possession of a concealed and unlicensed handgun. The others paid a fine and got out. Gardner did 2 months. His lawyer told him he was lucky. Gardner asked his lawyer if he knew he was sitting on a time bomb and jerking his meat. His lawyer asked him if he had considered psychiatric help. Gardner asked his lawyer if he had ever considered getting stopped. But he had had sense enough not to attend any more demonstrations. That much, anyway. He kept away from them. They were poisoning him. When he got drunk, however, his mind, whatever the booze had left of it, returned obsessively to the subject of the reactors, the core rods, the containments, the inability to slow down a runaway once it really got going. To the nukes, in other words. When he got drunk, his heart got hot. The nukes. The goddamn nukes. It was symbolic, yeah, okay, you didn't have to be Freud to figure out what he was really protesting was the reactor in his own heart. When it came to matters of restraint, James Gardner had a bad containment system. There was some technician inside who should have long since been fired. He sat and played with all the wrong switches. That guy wouldn't really be happy until Jim Gardner went China syndrome. The goddamn fucking nukes. Forget it. He tried. For a start, he tried thinking about tonight's reading at Northeastern, a fun-filled frolic that was being sponsored by a group that called itself the Friends of Poetry, a name which filled Gardner with fear and trembling. Groups with such names tended to be made up exclusively of women who called themselves ladies, most of them of a decidedly blue-haired persuasion. The ladies of the club tended to be a good deal more familiar with the works of Rod McEwen than those of John Berryman, Hart Crane, Ron Cummings, or that good old drunken blackout brawler and wife-shooter, James Eric Gardner. Get out of here, Gard. Never mind the New England Poetry Caravan, never mind Northeastern or the Friends of Poetry or the McArdle bitch. Get out of here right now before something bad happens. Something really bad. Because if you stay, something really bad will. There's blood on the moon. But he was damned if he'd go running back to Maine with his tail between his legs. Not him. Besides, there was the bitch. Patricia McArdle was her name, and if she wasn't one strutting, world-class bitch, Guard had never met one. She had a contract, and it specified, no play, no pay. Jesus, Gardner said, and put a hand over his eyes, trying to shut away the growing headache, knowing there was only one kind of medicine that would do that, and also knowing it was exactly the sort of medicine that could bring that really bad thing on. And also knowing that knowing would do no good at all. So, after a while, the booze started to flow and the cyclone started to blow. Jim Gardner. Now in freefall. 4. Patricia McCardle was the New England Poetry Caravan's principal contributor and head ramrod. Her legs were long but skinny, her nose aristocratic but too blade-like to be considered attractive. Gard had once tried to imagine kissing her and had been horrified by the image which had risen, unbidden, in his mind. Her nose not just sliding up his cheek, but slicing it open like a razor blade. She had a high forehead, non-existent breasts, and eyes as gray as a glacier on a cloudy day. She traced her ancestry back to the Mayflower. Gardner had worked for her before, and there had been trouble before. He had become part of the 1988 New England Poetry Caravan in rather grisly fashion. But the reason for his abrupt inclusion was no more unheard of in the world of poetry than it was in those of jazz and rock and roll. Patricia McCardle had been left with a last-minute hole in her announced program because one of the 6 poets who had signed on for this summer's happy cruise had hung himself in his closet with his belt. "Just like Phil Oakes," Ron Cummings had said to Gardner as they sat near the back of the bus on the first day of the tour. He said it with a nervous, bad boy at the back of the classroom giggle. But then Bill Quatsworth always was a derivative son of a bitch. Patricia McCardle had gotten 12 reading dates and fairly good advances on a deal which, when stripped of all the high-flown rhetoric, boiled down to 6 poets for the price of 1. Following Quatsworth's suicide, she found herself with 3 days to find a publishing poet in a season when most publishing poets were booked solid, or on permanent vacation like silly Billy Quatsworth, Cummings said, laughing rather uneasily. Few, if any, of the booked groups would balk at paying the stipulated fee just because the caravan happened to be short 1 poet. To do such a thing would be in rather shitty taste, particularly when one considered the reason the caravan was a poet short. All the same, it put Caravan Incorporated in a position of contractual default, at least technically, and Patricia McCardle was not a woman to brook loopholes. After trying 4 poets, each more minor league than the last, and with only 36 hours before the first reading, she had finally called Jim Gardner. "Are you still drinking, Jimmy?" she asked bluntly. Jimmy. He hated that. Most people called him Jim. Jim was all right. No one called him Gard except himself and Bobby Anderson. "Drinking a little," he said. "Not binging at all." "I'm dubious," she said coldly. "You always have been, Patty," he replied, knowing she hated that even more than he did Jimmy. Her Puritan blood screamed against it. "Were you asking because you happened to be short a quart, or did you have a more pressing reason?" Of course he knew, and of course she knew he knew, and of course she knew he was grinning, and of course she was infuriated, and of course all of this tickled him just about to death, and of course she knew he knew that, too, and that was just the way he liked it. They sparred a few more minutes, and then came to what was not a marriage of convenience, but one of necessity. Gardner wanted to buy a good used wood furnace for the coming winter. He was tired of living like a slut, bundled up at night in front of the kitchen stove while the wind rattled the plastic stapled over the windows. Patricia McCardle wanted to buy a poet. There would be no handshake agreement, though, not with Patricia McCardle. She had driven down from Derry that afternoon with a contract, in triplicate, and a notary public. Gard was a little surprised she hadn't brought a second notary just in case the first one happened to suffer a coronary or something. Feelings and hunches aside, there was really no way he could leave the tour and get the wood furnace, because if he left the tour, he would never see the second half of his fee. She'd haul him into court and spend $1,000 trying to get him to cough up the $300 Caravan Incorporated had paid up front. She might be able to do it, too. He had done almost all the dates, but the contract he had signed was crystal clear on the subject. If he took off for any reason unacceptable to the tour coordinator, any and all fees unpaid shall be declared null and void, and any and all fees prepaid shall be refundable to Caravan Incorporated within 30 days. And she would go after him. She might think she was doing it on principle, but it would really be because he had called her Patty in her hour of need. Nor would that be the end of it. If he left, she would work with unflagging energy to get him blackballed. He would certainly never read again for another poetry tour with which she was associated, and that was a lot of poetry tours. Then there was the delicate matter of grants. Her husband had left her a lot of money, although he didn't think you could say, as Ron Cummings did, that she practically had money falling out of her asshole, because Gard didn't believe Patricia McCardle had anything so vulgar as an asshole or even a rectum. When in need of relief, she probably performed an act of immaculate excretion. Patricia McCardle had taken a great deal of this money and set up a number of grants in aid. This made her simultaneously a serious patron of the arts and an extremely smart businesswoman in regard to the nasty business of income taxes. The grants were write-offs. Some of them funded poets for specific time periods. Some funded cash poetry awards and prizes, and some underwrote magazines of modern poetry and fiction. The grants were administered by committees. Behind each of them moved the hand of Patricia McCardle, making sure that they meshed as neatly as the pieces of a Chinese puzzle, or the strands of a spider's web. She could do a lot more to him than get back her lousy $600. She could muzzle him. And it was just possible, unlikely, but possible, that he might write a few more good poems before the madman who had stuffed a shotgun up the asshole of the world decided to pull the trigger. "So get through it," he thought. He had ordered a bottle of Johnny Walker from room service. God bless the tab forever and ever, amen. And now he poured his second drink with a hand that had become remarkably steady. Get through it, that's all. But as the day wore on, he kept thinking about grabbing a Greyhound bus at the Stewart Street terminal and getting off 5 hours later in front of the dusty little drugstore in Unity, thumbing a ride up to Troy from there, calling Bobby Anderson on the phone and saying, "I almost went up in the cyclone, Bobby, but I found the storm cellar just in time. Lucky break, huh?" "Shit on that. You make your own luck. If you be strong, Guard, you be lucky. Get through it, that's all. That's what's to do." He scrummed through his tote bag, looking for the best clothes he had left, since his reading clothes appeared to be beyond salvage. He tossed a pair of faded jeans, a plain white shirt, a tattered pair of skivvies, and a pair of socks onto the bedspread. "Thanks, ma'am, but there's no need to make up the room. I slept in the tub." He got dressed, ate some certs, ate some booze, ate some more certs, and then went through the bag again, this time looking for the aspirin. He found it and ate some of those. He looked at the bottle, looked away. The pulse of the headache was getting worse. He sat down by the window with his notebooks, trying to decide what he should read that night. In this dreadful long afternoon light, all his poems looked as if they had been written in Punic. Instead of doing anything positive about his headache, the aspirin seemed to actually be intensifying it. Slam, bam, thank you, ma'am. His head whacked with each heartbeat. It was the same old headache, the one that felt like an auger made of dull steel being slowly driven into his head at a point slightly above and to the left of his left eye. He touched the tips of his fingers to the faint scar there and ran his fingers lightly along it. The steel plate buried under the skin there was the result of a skiing accident in his teens. He remembered the doctor saying, "You may suffer headaches from time to time, son. When they come, just thank God you can feel anything. You're lucky to be alive." But at times like this, he wondered. At times like this, he wondered a lot. He put the notebooks aside with a shaking hand and closed his eyes. "I can't get through it." "You can." "I can't. There's blood on the moon. I feel it. I can almost see it." "Don't give me any of your Irish willy-wags. Just get tough, you weak fucking sister. Tough." "I'll try," he muttered, not opening his eyes. And 15 minutes later, when his nose began to bleed slightly, he didn't notice. He had fallen asleep in the chair. 5. He always got stage fright before reading, even if the group was a small one, and groups which turned out to hear readings of modern poetry tended to be just that. On the night of June 27th, however, Jim Gardiner's stage fright was intensified by his headache. When he woke from his nap in the hotel room chair, the shakes and the fluttery stomach were gone, but the headache had gotten even worse. It had graduated to a genuine Class A thumper and world beater, maybe the worst of all time. When his turn to read finally came, He seemed to hear himself from a great distance. He felt a little like a man listening to a recording of himself on a shortwave broadcast coming in from Spain or Portugal. Then a wave of lightheadedness coursed through him, and for a few moments he could only pretend to be looking for a poem, some special poem, perhaps, that had been temporarily misplaced. He shuffled papers with dim and nerveless fingers, thinking, "I'm going to faint, I think. Right up here in front of everyone. Fall against this lectern and pitch both it and me into the front row. Maybe I can land on that blue-blooded cunt and kill her. That would almost make my whole life seem worthwhile." "Get through it," that implacable inner voice responded. Sometimes that voice sounded like his father's. More often it sounded like the voice of Bobby Anderson. "Get through it, that's all. That's what's to do." The audience that night was larger than usual. Maybe 100 people squeezed behind the desks of a northeastern lecture hall. Their eyes seemed too big.
"What big eyes you have, Grandma."
It was as if they would eat him up with their eyes, suck out his soul, his ka, his whatever you wanted to call it. A snatch of old T-Rex occurred to him. "Girl, I'm just a vampire for your love, and I'm gonna suck you." Of course, there was no more T-Rex. Mark Bolan had wrapped his sports car around a tree and was lucky not to be alive. "Bang a gong, Mark, you sure got it on. Or got it off, or whatever. A group called Power Station is going to cover your turn in 1986, and it's going to be really bad. He raised an unsteady hand to his forehead, and a quiet murmur ran through the audience.
"Better get going, guard. Natives are getting restless."
Yeah, that was Bobby's voice, all right. The fluorescence, embedded in pebbled rectangles overhead, seemed to be pulsing in cycles which perfectly matched the cycles of pain driving into his head. He could see Patricia McCardle. She was wearing a little black dress that surely hadn't cost a penny more than $300. Distress sale stuff from one of those tacky little shops on Newberry Street. Her face was as narrow and pallid and unforgiving as that of any of her Puritan forebears, those wonderful fun-loving guys who had been more than happy to stick you in some stinking jail for 3 or 4 weeks if you had the bad luck to be spied going out on the Sabbath day without a snot rag in your pocket. Patricia's dark eyes lay upon him like dusty stones, and Guard thought,
"She sees what's happening, and she couldn't be more pleased. Look at her. She's waiting for me to fall down, and when I do, you know what she'll be thinking, don't you?"
Of course he did.
"That's what you get for calling me Patty, you drunken son of a bitch."
That was what she would be thinking.
"That's what you get for calling me Patty. That's what you get for doing everything but making me get down on my knees and beg. So go on, Gardner. Maybe I'll even let you keep the upfront money. $300 seems a cheap enough price to pay for the exquisite pleasure of watching you crack up in front of all these people. Go on. Go on and get it over with."
Some members of the audience were becoming visibly uneasy now. The delay between poems had stretched out far beyond what might be considered normal. The murmur had become a muted buzz. Gardner heard Ron Cummings clear his throat uneasily behind him.
"Get tough,"
Bobby's voice yelled again, but the voice was fading now. Fading, getting ready to high-side it. He looked at their faces and saw only pasty pale blank circles, ciphers, big white holes in the universe. The buzz was growing. He stood at the podium, swaying noticeably now, wetting his lips, looking at his audience with a kind of numb dismay. And then, suddenly, instead of hearing Bobby, Gardner actually saw her. This image had all the force of vision. Bobby was up there in Haven, up there right now. He saw her sitting in her rocking chair, wearing a pair of shorts and a halter top over what boob she had, which wasn't much. There was a pair of battered old mocks on her feet, and Peter was curled before them, deeply asleep. She had a book, but wasn't reading it. It lay open face down in her lap. This fragment of vision was so perfect, Gardner could even read the book's title. It was Watchers by Dean Koontz. While Bobby looked out the window into the dark, thinking her own thoughts. Thoughts which would follow one after the other as sanely and rationally as you could want a train of thought to run. No derailments. No late freights. No head-on. Bobby knew how to run a railroad.
He even knew what she was thinking about, he discovered.
Something in the woods.
Something. It was something she had found in the woods.
Yes. Bobby was in Haven, trying to decide what that thing might be and why she felt so tired. She was not thinking about James Eric Gardner, the noted poet, protester, and Thanksgiving wife shooter, who was currently standing in a lecture hall at Northeastern University under these lights with five other poets and some fat shit named Arberg or Argelbargel or something like that, and getting ready to faint. Here in this lecture hall stood the master of disaster, God bless Bobby, who had somehow managed to keep her shit together while all about her people were losing theirs. Bobby was up there in Haven, thinking the way people were supposed to think.
No, she's not. She's not doing that at all.
Then, for the first time, the thought came through with no soundproofing around it. It came through as loud and urgent as a fire bell in the night.
Bobby's in trouble. Bobby's in real trouble.
This surety struck him with the force of a roundhouse slap, and suddenly the lightheadedness was gone. He fell back into himself with such a thud he almost seemed to feel his teeth rattled. A sickening bolt of pain ripped through his head, but even that was welcome. If he felt pain, then he was back here, here, not drifting around someplace in the ozone. And for one puzzling moment, he saw a new picture. Very brief, very clear, and very ominous. It was Bobby in the cellar of the farmhouse she'd inherited from her uncle. She was hunkered down in front of some piece of machinery, working on it. Or was she? It seemed so dark, and Bobby wasn't much of a hand with mechanical stuff, but she sure was doing something because ghostly blue fire leapt and flickered between her fingers as she fiddled with tangled wires inside. But it was too dark to see what that dark cylindrical shape was. It was familiar. Something he had seen before, but then he could hear as well as see, although what he heard was even less comforting than that eldritch blue fire. It was Peter. Peter was howling. Bobby took no notice, and that was utterly unlike her. She only went on fiddling with the wires, jiggering them so they would do something down there in the root-smelling dark of the cellar. The vision broke apart on rising voices. The faces which went with those voices were no longer white holes in the universe, but the faces of real people. Some were amused, but not many. A few more embarrassed, but most just seemed alarmed or worried. Most looked, in other words, the way he would have looked had his position been reversed with one of them. Had he been afraid of them?
Had he?
If so, why? Only Patricia McCardle didn't fit. She was looking at him with a quiet, sure satisfaction that brought him all the way back. Gardner suddenly spoke to the audience, surprised at how natural and pleasant his voice sounded.
"I'm sorry. Please excuse me. I've got a batch of new poems here, and I went wool-gathering among them, I'm afraid."
Pause. Smile. Now he could see some of the worried ones settling back, looking relieved. There was a little laughter, but it was sympathetic. He could, however, see a flush of anger rising in Patricia McCardle's cheeks, and it did his headache a world of good.
"Actually," he went on, "even that's not the truth. Fact is, I was trying to decide whether or not to read some of this new stuff to you. After some furious sparring between those two thundering heavyweights, Pride of Authorship and Prudence, Prudence has won a split decision. Pride of Authorship vows to appeal the decision."
More laughter. Heartier.
Now old Patty's cheeks looked like his kitchen stove through its little isinglass windows on a cold winter night. Her hands were locked together, the knuckles white. Her teeth weren't quite bared, but almost, friends and neighbors. Almost. "In the meantime, I'm going to finish with a dangerous act. I'm going to read a fairly long poem from my first book, Grimoire."
He winked in Patricia McCardle's direction, then took them all into his humorous confidence.
"But God hates a coward, right?" Ron snorted laughter behind him, and then they were all laughing. And for a moment he actually did see a glint of her pearly whites behind those stretched, furious lips, and oh boy, howdy, that was just about as good as you'd want, wasn't it?
Watch out for her, guard. You think you've got your boot on her neck now, and maybe you even do for the moment. But watch out for her. She won't forget. Or forgive.
But that was for later. Now he opened the battered copy of his first book of poems. He didn't need to look for Leighton Street. The book fell open to it of its own accord. His eyes found the subscript. For Bobby, who first smelled sage in New York. Leighton Street had been written the year he met her. The year Leighton Street was all she could talk about. It was, of course, the street in Utica where she had grown up. The street she'd needed to escape before she could even start being what she wanted to be. A simple writer of simple stories. She could do that. She could do that with flash and ease. Guard had known that almost at once. Later that year, he had sensed that she might be able to do more. To surmount the careless, profligate ease with which she wrote, and do, if not great work, grave work. But first, she had to get away from Leighton Street. Not the real one, but the Leighton Street which she carried with her in her mind. A demon geography populated by haunted tenements, her sick, loved father, her weak, loved mother, and her defiant crone of a sister, who rode over them all like a demon of endless power. Once that year, she had fallen asleep in class. Freshman comp, that had been. He had been gentle with her because he already loved her a little, and he had seen the huge circles under her eyes. "I've had problems sleeping at night," she said, when he held her after class for a moment. She had still been half asleep, or she never would have gone on from there. That was how powerful Anne's hold, which was the hold of Leighton Street, had been over her. But she was like a person who had been drugged and exists with one leg thrown over each side of sleep's dark and stony wall. End of side two. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.